From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young, along with Peter O'Dowd. It's Here and Now. President Trump is dismissing that bombshell New York Times story about his tax returns, which he's resisted making public since before his election. Reporters looked at more than two decades of his returns and found that Trump paid no federal income taxes in 11 out of the 18 years they examined. He paid only $750 the year he moved into the White House. He escaped taxes by declaring losses on many of his businesses, taking questionable tax deductions for personal expenses, and getting a huge tax refund for which he is being audited. He's also deeply in debt, over $400 million in loans coming due in the coming years, owed to who? The Times is promising more revelations ahead, but let's bring in former New York Times tax reporter David K. Johnston, co-founder of the DC Report, who may be saying today, I told you so. David, you have been sounding an alarm like this. What jumped out at you from this reporting?
Well, on one level, it's great that this and all the recent books that are coming out are confirming what I've been writing for years. But the important issue here is that Donald Trump was in financial trouble before he came into the White House. He's in financial trouble now, and he owes a minimum of $300 million in personally guaranteed loans without the capacity to repay them unless he sells his properties, all of which, because of the coronavirus, would go at fire sale prices. And that it is should be eminently clear now that Donald Trump is a massive serial criminal tax cheat.
Well, look, I got to stop you there because you say criminal. And we're hearing tax experts explain that real estate is notoriously difficult to investigate and that there is a legitimate difference between tax avoidance, which is legal and a lot of Americans try to do it. How can I not pay that tax? And tax evasion, which is illegal. What are you seeing
here? That is absolutely true. And if I didn't know all the things I know about Donald Trump's finances, that's the answer that I would give you because that's the textbook answer. But the Times has documented here that Donald has improperly deducted personal expenses as business expenses. He has made what looks pretty clearly to be a disguised gift to his daughter so that instead of paying about $300,000 of gift tax, he got a tax deduction worth roughly the same amount of money. And keep this in mind, Robin. 4 years ago, I broke the story that Donald Trump has had two civil fraud trials. Tax fraud trials. He lost both of these trials. In the trial, he was shown by his own witness to be a forger. He could have been indicted then for forgery for the tax return that he filed after his own tax lawyer and accountant testified against him in that case. And, of course, the project the Times did 2 years ago, based on records they got from Mary Trump, they didn't beat around the bush. The Times said he had committed tax fraud.
David, in the minute or so we have, what else jumps out at you about, for instance, what Donald Trump may owe foreign countries and what that means?
Well, Donald Trump, our disclosure laws have a lot of holes in them. Donald Trump owes Deutsche Bank over $300 million. There's very, very good reason to believe that those loans were actually concealed loans from Russian criminals. Russian criminal deposits the money with Deutsche Bank. Donald Trump then gets a loan equal to the deposit. That means Donald Trump, if that's the case, is subject to leverage by these criminal elements. And it would help explain why Donald Trump never speaks critically of Vladimir Putin. In fact, he has said he trusts Vladimir Putin, but not American intelligence agencies.
David K. Johnston, the president, of course, is calling this fake news. He says he has paid lots of taxes. I'm wondering if that could be, local or state. This is federal. He's accused of not paying. Many in his circle are saying that it's fake news. What more do you think might come out, just very briefly?
Donald could make all of this go away by simply releasing his Form 1040, just two pages, for every year back to 2000. Why don't you just show us that? And he'll say, I'm under audit. Well, so what? You filed your tax return. There's no reason. The IRS has said there's no reason not to release your returns. Richard Nixon released his return. And the reason he doesn't want you to see it is people will discover that while he claims to be a billionaire, and I've shown in the past when he made that claim it was false. He really has not paid taxes. He has manipulated the tax system, and he's not who he appears to be. He is certainly not a businessman. Yeah. He is, as I've documented in my books and articles, a cash extractor, not a wealth builder.
David K. Johnston, co-founder of the D.C. Report, author, and also former New York Times investigative and tax reporter. David, thank you.
Thank you.
And let's go now to another story that's dominating the days ahead as it did the weekend. Supreme Court nominee Amy Coney Barrett's Senate confirmation hearing will begin on October 12th, just weeks before the presidential election. The Republican-controlled Senate is expected to quickly confirm Barrett, and that leaves Democrats who want to slow the process with few options. NPR congressional reporter Claudia Grisales is with us now. Hi, Claudia.
Hi there.
So as we know, Trump officially nominated this very attractive to many people candidate, Barrett, on Saturday at the White House, her whole family there, seven children. We now have a date for when her confirmation hearing will begin. What's next?
So, yes, we have that date of October 12th. This was laid out by South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham. He's chairman of the Judiciary Committee. He says following that beginning of the hearings, it'll be followed by 2 days of questioning, and then the committee will report the nomination out for Barrett out of committee, perhaps by October 22nd, so about 10 days after the start of these hearings. And Graham said Barrett would get a, quote, full, fair hearing in that time. It'd be up to Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell to schedule a vote for the full Senate. And that would land perhaps about 10 or so days before Election Day. And it appears McConnell has the Republican votes to confirm Barrett, even if all the Democrats are opposed. But at the same time, that time frame does not leave a lot of room for the panel to finish the FBI background check and review answers to the committee's lengthy questionnaire that nominees submit ahead of the hearings.
Yeah. And what's been the reaction over the weekend? We know conservatives really rallied around her in 2017 when she was nominated to the U.S. Court of Appeals.
Yes, we saw a real swell of support among Republicans to applaud Trump's pick of Barrett and pushing for her confirmation, swift confirmation. They think she checks all the right boxes when it comes to her record of being a conservative, concerns she's raised about Roe v. Wade and how she could push the court further to the right. They're hopeful that this will happen. But at the same time, Democrats, those on the left, it's a completely different story. Her conservative record conflicts with a lot of their values and positions. And this is just a continuation of a frustration that Republicans are moving full speed ahead when voting is underway already in some states, and they refused to do so 4 years ago with the Democratic nominee many months ahead of the election in 2016.
So talk about what Democrats are doing. We heard both Joe Biden and Nancy Pelosi over the weekends, you know, excoriate or not actually maybe more beg or plead with their Republican senator colleagues to delay this, to, quote, do the right thing. But on the other hand, this means that this might be a done deal before the election, and conservatives who may not have wanted to vote for Trump, but would have because of the nomination, now will have the nomination before the election. So what are Democrats doing?
So Democrats admit they have limited tools here to slow down this process. They can perhaps slow it down by a matter of hours or days, but they can't stop the outcome. So, yes, indeed, we could see this confirmation happen before Election Day. That said, some Democrats, especially on the Senate Judiciary Committee, say they plan to take part in these hearings, question this nominee, and they also want to make this a campaign issue, pointing to issues like the Affordable Care Act and concerns about health care, if that could be jeopardized if Barrett joins this court and pushes it even more to the right. And so they're using this as a campaign issue, and they're stalling where they can. And they are pleading as well to see if any Republicans, moderate Republicans, those facing some tough reelection fights, and seeing if they might have a change of heart.
Yeah. In the minute or so we have left, let's listen to what President Trump is saying. He called out Democrats for any critiques of Judge Barrett.
And now Democrats are really brazenly attacking Judge Barrett for, again, her faith, mostly is what I'm hearing, for her Catholic faith. And whether it's Dianne Feinstein or anybody else, I think they ought to treat religion with much more respect.
Well, and that from Dianne Feinstein was at another confirmation a while back. Are Democrats attacking her for her faith? Nancy Pelosi's Catholic. And do you think it'll be a bigger point of contention?
You know, Republicans are hoping it will be. This is where they're hoping to push the discussion, claiming that Democrats are attacking Barrett already for her faith. But this is not something I'm seeing Democratic leaders or lawmakers bringing up as an issue. They're even pointing out that their nominee, Joe Biden, is Catholic. And so this is not an area they want to go into. So Republicans are really hoping to fuel this as a wedge issue. But Democrats are hoping to make clear this isn't something they support. And their concerns are more on an ideological scale, not religious, like protecting the affordable Care Act and concerns about new abortion restrictions.
Yeah. NPR congressional reporter Claudia Grisales, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Climate change could be a key issue for many young voters in this election, and Democratic nominee Joe Biden hopes they'll support him over President Trump.
If you give a climate arsonist 4 more years in the White House, why would anyone be surprised if we have more America ablaze? If you give a climate denier 4 more years in the White House, why would anyone be surprised when more of America is underwater?
The youth-led environmental group known as the Sunrise Movement gave Biden's climate plan an F during the Democratic primaries, but since then they've been advising his campaign and pushing him on the issue. Araceli Jimenez is Deputy Communications Director for the Sunrise Movement, and she joins us now. And Araceli, Joe Biden originally called for decarbonizing the electric grid by 2050. He's moved that goal forward now to 2035, but what else would you like to see from his campaign? Because I understand that your group has still not officially endorsed him.
Mm-hmm. You know, Joe Biden's climate plan, in addition to that shorter timeline, it now has upped the investments to $2 trillion over 4 years on clean energy investments, with 40% of those investments to frontline communities. And, you know, we could always be spending more on climate, right? I mean, we've seen just in the past month how absolutely devastating the fires out west have been. The hurricanes, storms, floods that have hit the Gulf South and other areas of the country, it's really only going to get worse. And so, you know, climate plans really need to be as ambitious as possible. And like I said, you know, we're really glad that Biden has shown he's accountable to the people. And we really see, you know, Sunrise Movement and young people more generally, our role as, you know, pushing the administration and a new Congress and really representatives at all levels of government to mobilize the full force of our budgets to transforming our economy.
But to win, Joe Biden is going to need the votes of young people. He's going to need the votes of the progressive mm-hmm. wing of the Democratic Party. Of the progressives that you know, are they on board with Joe Biden, and will they be voting for him in November?
Look, I mean, you know, you bring up a great point. You know, Trump is really publicly making plans to steal the election, which means that Biden has to win in a landslide. We as the movement can only do so much to inspire our own people. And I think Biden needs to give more speeches like he gave from Delaware last week, you know, in no uncertain terms, calling for a restructuring of our economy, creating millions of good paying union jobs, giving them to workers ready to rebuild this country. And so we definitely need to hear more of that to make sure that young people actually deliver a landslide victory in the next few weeks.
So if I'm hearing you correctly, it sounds like you're saying he needs to do more to get that vote. Now, as you point out rightly, the election will likely be very close and Donald Trump might win. What's your strategy in that case if there's another 4 years of Donald Trump in the White House?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, our strategy, who's to say? I'm actually, you know, my personal philosophy is to not worry about a day that hasn't come yet.
Well, isn't that what the climate movement is all about?
Well, I mean, I think that's an issue that's been with the part of the climate movement, being too worried about the future. The reality is people are suffering and dying right now. Communities need investments right now. And Biden has an incredible opportunity with these debates coming up. And everything, every poll across the board shows that climate is the swing issue this election, which means with the eyes of the nation on him, Biden has the opportunity to speak to key voters, to speak to young people. and put Trump on his back foot on his weakest issue of climate. If Biden can keep pushing his talking points about how strong his climate plan is and how it's actually, you know, meeting the demands of young people who are demanding a Green New Deal, who are demanding robust climate action, then Biden has, you know, a much better chance of winning the election in a landslide and outmaneuvering Trump's public plans to steal the election.
Now, if climate does come up at those debates, Donald Trump is likely to say that Joe Biden's policy will destroy the American economy. He might quote the oil and gas industry, who says that Biden's plan will crush union jobs. And for better or worse, true or not, that's going to resonate with a lot of people. What do you say?
But, you know, it's the media's responsibility to make sure that we don't let Trump off the hook, ruin the economy. The economy's ruined. It's ruined right now. You know, it's really the responsibility of Chris Wallace and Steve Scully and Kristen Welker. You know, I'm calling on all of them right now.
They need
to step up in their responsibility. Right now, as Chris Wallace has released the first presidential debate topics and climate was nowhere to be seen, the moderators really have a responsibility to inform the public and make sure that the presidential debates are covering these swing issues.
You bring up an interesting point. I mean, maybe the reason it isn't scheduled to come up in that debate is because climate change has never really ranked all that high on the minds of American voters. Why do you think that is?
Well, you know, I think that we've seen the influence of fossil fuel money from corporate PACs, their lobbyists, their masterclass in sowing doubt and denial over the past decades, since before I was even born, has, you know, really influenced the political establishment and the political elite of this country. And now we have incredible champions like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. You know, we've just sent Ed Markey back to the Senate. We're sending Jamal Bowman to the next Congress. These incredible people who have run their entire campaigns on the Green New Deal, banking on the support of young people, and have won with overwhelming enthusiasm. And so now we're seeing that we have actual grassroots champions who are willing to go to bat for working people, talking about the intersections between climate, the COVID crisis, and the economy. And that's why we're seeing this surge, because we finally have that inside power, and we can finally have voices that are being heard across this country making those key connections.
Araceli Jimenez, Deputy Communications Director for the Sunrise Movement. It was a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Peter. Happy to be here anytime.
Well, let's go north now. Since March, Canada has closed its borders with the U.S. to all but non-essential travel, and that's upended life in border communities. In the tiny town of Hyder, Alaska, with most amenities in neighboring British Columbia, the restrictions have disrupted when residents can shop for groceries or even whether kids can attend school. Coast Alaska's Jacob Resnick reports.
At the tip of Alaska's panhandle lies the curious town of Hyder. In many ways, it has more in common with British Columbia than Alaska. It shares a time zone, area code, and only road out with its Canadian neighbors.
There's about 65 of us. The only way we get supplies is through a mail plane that comes in from Ketchikan twice a week, Mondays and Thursdays, weather permitting.
Wes Lowe is the Hyder Community Association's president, who acts as a sort of unofficial mayor. People in Hyder get their groceries, fuel, and other supplies in neighboring Stewart, B.C., just over the border. But then came the pandemic.
Since March, we can only go to Stewart once every 7 days for 3 hours to get whatever we need.
That's literally divided families with relatives in both countries. Jennifer Jean is co-chair of the cross-border committee that's led a letter-writing campaign to Canadian officials.
We have no amenities in Hyder. We have no gas stations, no grocery stores, no medical facilities.
There's no school either. Low enrollment led the school district in Alaska to shutter Hyder's small school earlier this year. But there was a workaround. Stewart, BC's elementary school agreed to enroll Hyder's 5 school-age children.
It's a little bit tough because there is only 5 school-age kids, and their friends are just right across that border.
Nick Corpola has 2 daughters in Hyder, 8 and 10.
You know, they didn't get to see them all summer, but we promised them that, you know, they were going to get to go to school and see their friends then. And 2 days before, we got a call from the Canadian Customs, and they said that they were not going to allow the children through the border.
His oldest daughter, Hilma, says she was looking forward to being a Canadian fifth grader.
I was kind of sad. I was like, oh, great, one more thing. to not be able to do.
Jennifer Jean also has two school-age children.
It's really, really hard on them. That was the light at the end of the tunnel for them, was to be able to see their friends again, have a little bit of normalcy in their lives.
The committee has redoubled its efforts to reopen the border. It's gotten support from provincial officials in BC, Alaska's governor, and elected officials in both countries. But it's important to add some larger context here. U.S. and Canada's infection numbers are starkly different. There have been no reported cases of COVID-19 in either town, but with no medical clinic in Hyder, there hasn't been any testing either. Canada has had about 9,200 reported deaths. Compare that to the U.S., which just broke the 200,000 mark.
The larger border situation remains very worrisome for many Canadians, and there's strong support for keeping the Canada-U.S. border closed, given the stark difference in the situation on either side of the border.
Taylor Bachrach is a Canadian member of Parliament representing Stewart, B.C. He supports relaxing the border restrictions and has been talking to Prime Minister Justin Trudeau's cabinet officials since August.
It feels like there's pretty strong support for some sort of solution. So I'm curious why it's taking so long to put something in place.
So far, it's not to be. A spokesperson for Canada's Public Safety Ministry reaffirmed that there are no exemptions from Canada's quarantine restrictions for school children living in the U.S. But residents in Hyder and Stewart haven't given up. They've held regular rallies at the border. They're calling for the Bear Bubble. That would create a shared quarantine area for residents living in both communities. For Here and Now, I'm Jacob Resnick.
France is one of several European countries dealing with a second wave of coronavirus. The country has recorded more than 577,000 cases and 31,000 deaths since the pandemic started earlier this year. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley joins us now from Paris. And Eleanor, how serious is the new wave of infections in France?
I mean, it's pretty serious. It's not like last spring, but they're having, you know, regularly 10,000 plus cases in every 24 hours. A couple days ago, there were even 16,000 new cases in a day. And what's different from last spring is last spring, it was in, you know, the East was very hard hit and Paris was very hard hit. Now it's sort of spread generally throughout the entire country. And so there are 11 major towns such as Paris, Lyon, Lille, Bordeaux, Strasbourg, where they've shut all the gymnasiums starting today. You can't go work out at your gym, and restaurants have to close at 10 p.m. And then the city of Marseille has been very hard hit, and restaurants and bars have been closed completely down there.
Is it fair to say that maybe people have let their guard down? I've seen some pictures of people just packing into restaurants in Paris. It doesn't look like there's a lot of social distancing going on.
You know, it's interesting. Maybe you've seen that, and I have seen people close together when they're seated somewhere. Because technically, when you go into a restaurant, you have to wear a mask, and when you get up from your table, but when you're sitting, you can take it off. But honestly, I mean, in Paris anyway, people are taking it very seriously. People are wearing masks, definitely wearing masks. You walk out in the street outside, and there is not one person not wearing a mask. I mean, you'd be very hard-pressed to find someone. Yeah, so it's impressive. I would say that there's a problem with testing. There is a problem with testing. There are long lines outside of laboratories and places where they're doing tests. And at least two of my friends who have been exposed to someone who had COVID went to get tests and they had to wait. They're waiting still. It's been 12 plus days for their results. Wow. So, you know, how can anything work if you've got to wait 12 days for your results? On the other hand, I do know someone who got their results in 24 hours, but it doesn't seem even, and the government has even expressed frustration about the length of time it takes to get results.
Huh. Well, a government official said today that there's no plan to order a new nationwide lockdown in France, and they're having trouble with testing, clearly. But so what's the government doing? Do they have a plan to kind of get this under control?
Yeah, well, the plan is regional restrictions. So, you know, yes, no, they do not want to lock the country down again like this past spring. It would just be devastating for the economy. Regional strategies such as closing bars and restaurants in Marseille. And also the government is just hammering the message. social distancing and wear your mask. And also they're asking vulnerable people to please stay inside, and they're asking people to, you know, be careful of the elderly and people who have underlying health conditions. So really keep the vulnerable safe, and everybody else wear your mask, social distancing, and regional strategies. That's it for now. And everyone is sort of nervous. It's like, you know, the weather has started to turn here. It's cold and rainy today. People are coming inside, and we don't really know what's going to happen.
Beyond France, what are you seeing elsewhere in Europe? It looks like Spain's having something of a relapse.
Spain is having a very big relapse. They've, you know, quarantined parts of the city of Madrid, which is said to be very complicated because you can't lock down part of a city and have other parts not locked down. Britain's been hard hit, and they're also closing pubs early. So everyone is sort of on edge now as we go into the fall season in Europe.
That's NPR's Eleanor Beardsley in Paris. Eleanor, thank you. Stay safe.
Thank you.
Protests continued through the weekend in Louisville, Kentucky, after a grand jury issued no charges last week against two police officers for shooting and killing Breonna Taylor in her apartment last March. And police body camera footage made public over the weekend shows one of those officers involved in the shooting inside the house afterward when police investigators were working, a violation of protocol. You remember officers used a no-knock warrant to try to find drug crime evidence against Breonna's ex-boyfriend, who didn't live there. She was asleep with her current boyfriend. Terrible. But also, it's raised questions again about no-knock warrants. Last week, Kentucky's Attorney General Daniel Cameron said the police who were serving a no-knock warrant did knock and identify themselves, something that's in dispute. Lanice Herbert is professor of law at Howard University and a former assistant U.S. attorney in D.C. Professor, welcome.
Thank you.
There is so much confusion around this case, so much to be sorted out. Now, what we want to get at in our conversation is, where are we on no-knock warrants in general? But just start with some of the things that we heard. Does it make sense that Kentucky's attorney general said the officers at Breonna Taylor's door did knock and identify themselves as police, when they're also saying that this was a no-knock warrant? Now, lawyers for Breonna's boyfriend say the witness only in later interviews said that the police announced themselves. Others in the area didn't hear anything. Does that make sense? You'd announce yourself and defend yourself that way when you had a no-knock, no-announce warrant?
Well, the entire purpose of the no-knock warrant, which is no-knock and no announce, the entire purpose is so that you catch those on the other side of the door off guard so that they won't destroy evidence. These are typically used in drug cases, and that there will be a matter of protection against damage or destruction to life, to limb, to property even. That they knocked, and apparently they pounded so significantly such that neighbors around could understand and hear that something was going on. They knocked but did not announce. And the lack of the announcement, we are the police, we are executing a warrant, that probably caused the most confusion on the other side of that door. Couple that with a battering ram. I mean, you have on the inside people who are probably very frightened, terrified, awakened from sleep. It was, I believe, after midnight when they executed this warrant.
Right. Yeah, everyone heard the pounding, but now at least one witness is saying they thought that they did hear them announce the police, but many other witnesses did not. Such confusion. But the bottom line is, as you say, the no-knock warrant is supposed to be a no-knock warrant. Still, even for those, you know, who are worried about the lives on the other side of a door that the ram is coming through, lives like Breonna Taylor's, also I would think people who care and have concern for the police officers and want them to be as safe as possible, it feels like that was the least, if they did announce, that was the least safe thing to do. But even if they didn't, if a battering ram comes through a door, and you have the right to defend your home and you don't know who it is, some of us are having a hard time understanding a no-knock warrant, period. It would seem as if it would always set up the people on the other side of the door to feel they're being attacked and not know it's the police.
Well, you're completely correct. And in fact, this is why no-knock warrants and no-announce warrants are in such dispute The concern, of course, is for law enforcement life as well. One of the reasons the Supreme Court has upheld these warrants is to protect law enforcement officers from those inside who might seek to thwart the governmental conduct, the searching, the seizing of items and arresting and such that might go on during the execution of the warrant. These are problematic in the inception as well as in the execution, because oftentimes officers don't execute them in accordance with the requirements that were set up by the Supreme Court. Oftentimes officers seem to be confused about how to execute them properly. According to the court, if this is a regular warrant where there's a knock and announce, the knock occurs, the announcement, police are here, and then there's supposed to be a time frame, the court has said 15 to 20 seconds, where the officers are to wait before then they attempt some sort of entry. The no knock, no announce is all about surprise. But you're absolutely right. If it's all about surprise, if it's to catch those inside off guard, then certainly that seems like police officers' lives are put in jeopardy by the mere execution of a warrant that otherwise is lawful.
No. Again, there's so much confusion. Lawyers for Breonna Taylor's family say it wasn't the grand jury who made this decision not to charge the officers who for shooting Breonna Taylor. One was charged for shooting into another apartment. But they say that it was the state attorney general who made this decision not to charge the officers. They want that grand jury transcript to be released. Right now, that's still a demand. But until we have that, we also aren't quite sure why they were there. I mean, there was some thinking initially that they were there to get Breonna Taylor's ex-boyfriend, who was being charged with drug offenses. But you say that he may already have been in detention?
There seems to have been a number of individuals who were already in custody based on execution of the warrant, one of which might have been the ex-boyfriend. But the concern about the charges in the grand jury, I am a former assistant U.S. attorney. I have placed cases before a grand jury, and I can tell you what they say about the grand jury generally is very, very true. Prosecutors can get an indictment. You can indict a ham sandwich before the grand jury. And that's because you're the only party there. You're the only one who is asking questions. You're the only one who's offering evidence. And prosecutors in that position almost always get an indictment. For some reason, though, in the United States, it seems that this doesn't occur when prosecutors are prosecuting law enforcement officers.
So you're saying they could have had an indictment of the officers if they wanted it. But put that aside, because right now we don't have the transcript. If, in fact, Breonna Taylor's boyfriend was already in custody, and if they were just coming to the apartment to look for evidence in his case, maybe something had been mailed there in his name, I don't understand why that would take a battering ram, why you couldn't knock on the door. I mean, can you get a no-knock warrant complete with battering ram and armed police officers to get evidence in a drug case?
It depends on what the law enforcement officers told the magistrate judge who issued the warrant. The warrant has to be based on probable cause. And yes, force can be contemplated, likely because the officers say things like, well, we expect they have guns, we expect they'll fight back.
Well, and as we've seen, there was violence from an innocent man who thought he was protecting his girlfriend and their home. So where are we on no-knock warrants? We know in June the Louisville Metro Council passed Breonna's law banning no-knock warrants and setting guidelines on how search warrants are executed. Most states now allow no-knock warrants after an okay from a judge or a magistrate, but Florida and Oregon have statewide bans. In Virginia, the House of Delegates passed a blanket prohibition. Pennsylvania has introduced Breonna's law, which would require law enforcement officers to knock and announce themselves when serving a warrant. Where are we and where are we headed with the no-knock warrant?
I mean, technically, this was not a no-knock warrant, yes? Everyone seems to indicate they knocked. So this was not even technically a no-knock warrant. So we're all over the place. Police officers aren't consistent with their execution of these. States aren't consistent with their requirements of these. Different cities within states and different jurisdictions within a state will differ, as we see now, even in Kentucky. So no-knock warrants are still constitutionally legitimate, but we have seen so many problems in the execution and the inconsistency of the execution that we literally are all over the map when it comes to no-knock warrants, legitimacy, and the execution consistency.
Well, and obviously it's not safe for citizens, innocent citizens on the other side of that door, but it's puzzling because it does not seem safe for police officers.
And the court is very concerned about the safety of law enforcement officers in the execution of the warrants. This is part of the reason why the no-knock warrant and the no-announce warrant came into being. What we're seeing is that these are dangerous. Even if they're done properly, even if they're done well, they present a level of danger on both sides of the equation that seems to be too great and growing too great to ignore.
That's Lenise Herbert, professor of law at Howard University and a former assistant district attorney in the District of Columbia. Professor Herbert, thank you.
Thank you.
Today, September 28th, would have been the 65th birthday of Kenny Kirkland, the jazz pianist known to his friends as the Doctor or Doctoon. Kirkland played with some of the greats back in the 80s and 90s. He died in 1998 at 43, leaving many to wonder what might have been. Among them, Noah Haidu, a Brooklyn-based pianist and composer who's leading a retrospective on Kenny Kirkland's life and work.
I started this project because of Kirkland's influence on my life. As a kid, I listened to Prince, Michael Jackson, The Police, but when I heard Kirkland bring a jazz sound to Sting's band, I got obsessed. He showed the relationship between jazz and popular music at a time when there wasn't much overlap between the two. Even Sting was impressed.
We jam, and, you know, I'm a big fan of Herbie Hancock, you know, McCoy Tyner, and all these people. Wow, this guy is way up there, and I hadn't heard of him before. So it was staggering what he could do.
Kenny Kirkland grew up in Brooklyn, playing classical music but loving R&B. Here he is on Marianne McPartland's Piano Jazz Show in 1987.
I started very young, classical lessons with the neighborhood pianist named Winifred Thompson, but I wasn't very much into it, you know, when I was a child. But I learned a lot, but I wasn't, like, enthusiastic about it until I got older.
After his older brother Frank brought home some jazz records, Kenny began a love affair. Before long, head started to turn. Here's guitarist Rodney Jones, one of Kirkland's early collaborators, talking about hearing Kenny practicing.
I knocked on the door, and I hear someone walk to the door, and the door opens and it's Kenny Kirkland. I'm like, Kenny, what are you doing here? He said, I'm just practicing. I said, that was you? He was like, yeah. Say very shyly, like, no, wait a minute. That piano playing that I was hearing outside, like, that was you? And I couldn't believe, I was stunned. I said, Kenny, how did you get so good?
Word got around about the young pianist. Here's his longtime drummer and friend, Jeff Tane Watts.
Talking about, you know, gigs and stuff, like at 17, 19 years old, 20, you know, early 20s, he's playing with everyone already. He was like in the fast lane so quickly. But anyway, went and whenever he would want to know the, you know, just the right chord changes to anything or just any kind of specific information, he would defer to Kenny. So he started calling Kenny the Doctor, because he knew everything. He's like, man, you're the Doctor. And so the Doctor just morphed into Doctor.
The Wynton Watts mentions is Wynton Marsalis, who hired Kirkland. Kenny's career took off, but his personal life had its challenges. He lost his father and had two crippling accidents which left him hospitalized. He was given morphine to treat his pain, which may have fueled the drug use he struggled with throughout his life. Still, he did record one album titled simply Kenny Kirkland. But there was much more to his music than that. So, with the backing of Sunnyside Records, I put together a tribute album with musicians who played with or were inspired by Kirkland. Here, I'm playing his composition, Dienda. One of the hard things about putting together a tribute to Kirkland is that even in the jazz world, many don't know much about the shy sideman. But collaborators like Sting got the full picture.
He was one of the greatest human beings I ever met. Incredibly talented, tortured, complex, dark, all of that stuff rolled into one Kenny Kirkland. I learned a lot from him. That way of approaching harmony, where there are no wrong notes, but just the note that you follow with. There are no mistakes in a Kenny Kirkland solo.
One of the reasons a project dedicated to Kirkland is so important to me is the thought of what could have been. He was set to record a second album, but on November 13th, 1998, Kenny Kirkland was found dead in his New York apartment, likely a drug overdose. He was 43.
Jazz pianist Noah Haidu will link you to his documentary about Kenny Kirkland at hereandnow.org. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.